Okay, would you like to turn with me then to Luke chapter 21? Luke 21. We got up as far as verse 12 last time, and we're in the Olivet Discourse. So again, these are the things that Jesus says to his disciples on the Mount of Olives on Tuesday the 12th of Nisan, and this is just 2 days before his crucifixion on Thursday the 14th. Or Good Thursday, if you like. Jesus rose on the third day, and that doesn't work if there's a Good Friday. So, and there are lots of other reasons as well for that. But he's been talking about how things are going to be in the immediate future for his disciples, and also in the last days for us. And those last days go from Pentecost up until the rapture. So it's kind of good for us to know these things. And I think it's worth mentioning, excuse me, that as we look at verse 12, we have a parenthesis there that is only found in Luke's gospel. Luke tells us something in these verses that we don't get anywhere else. So you need to take note of these things this morning. And really, chapter 25, verse 1, chapter 22, verse 1, picks up from verse 11 in this chapter. So from verses 12 to 24, we have a picture of the beginning of the persecution of Jerusalem before 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and exhortations from the Lord in regards to those things, which is different to what we find in Matthew and Mark's records. So in verse 12, after talking about the troubles of the age, he says, before all these things, they shall lay their hands upon or on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And then as we start this morning in verse 13, he says this, and it shall turn to you for a testimony. Or if you like, these things that I'm going to tell you about now will eventually turn out to be a testimony for you. And I look at that and I can't help thinking about what it must have been like for Luke as he wrote the book of Acts, writing to Theophilus at that time and saying, the former treatise I have made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began to both do and teach until the day which he was taken up, meaning, of course, his gospel that we're looking at this morning. What must it have been like for Luke putting the book of Acts down on paper, knowing about the things that Jesus has said in this chapter? Because again, the synagogue only had power to persecute the church before 70 AD. After Jerusalem's levelled and the synagogue loses its power, the Romans continue to persecute, but this is a picture of early on, and Jesus is saying this is all going to turn out to be a testimony for you. So he goes on to say, settle it therefore because of that in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay or speak against, nor resist. Now, he had said back in chapter 12, if you remember, when they bring you into the synagogues to the magistrates and powers, take you no thought how or what you shall answer or what you shall say. And he says there, for the Holy Ghost shall teach you in the same hour what you shall say. Here he says, I'll give you in the same hour mouth and wisdom, which none of your adversaries will be able to speak against or resist. So he says, look, this is going to happen, but I don't want you to be shocked. You know, in the book of Acts, that they're waiting there for the power of the Holy Spirit and they can't wait to get going. But he says, you need to understand something. You need to understand they hated me, so they're going to hate you. If you were of the world, the world would love you. But because you're not of the world, the world's going to hate you. So understand what you're headed into. And I mean, Paul is a great example of what Jesus says there. You know, what Jesus is trying to get them to understand. Because When he was brought before people like Felix and Festus and Agrippa and even Caesar Nero, Paul would use every opportunity to preach the gospel. So as we're looking at this morning, there's something as we go through this that we really need to understand about what Jesus is saying to each one of us today as well. Because the thing is, would you be able to do what Paul did in the same kind of circumstances? You know, the Lord doesn't give anyone the grace to die until a person is actually in the throes of dying. And the same is true concerning any difficult situation, really, because it's not until you're in that place that the Lord gives you the necessary and corresponding grace. I don't think there's any person alive who doesn't at some point in their life contemplate how they're going to die. You know, I'm sorry to be so cheerful, you know, but what Jesus is saying here and trying to put across to his disciples is the fact that God doesn't give you the grace to cope with that until you need it. So it's just stupid to worry about those things now. There's much more important things to concern ourselves with. And it's the same when we go out to talk to others about the Lord. The Lord will give you the words to say. And as far as the Holy Spirit is concerned, there's no point in worrying about what you're going to say before you need to say it. And it works, trust me. Or better still, trust him. Because as he says here to his disciples, and to you and me as well, settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries shall not be able to speak against nor resist. Now, verse 16 says this. He says here, and you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolks and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. And you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, but there shall not a hair of your head perish. In your patience possess you your souls. In other words, in the fullness of time, you will still have your souls. You know, in the first 250 years of the church, beginning with Caesar Nero and extending through the 10 waves of persecution that followed, a minimum of 6 million Christians were killed for their belief in Jesus Christ. And we look at that and we think, so, okay, well, how does this work out then when it says that you'll be betrayed and killed, but not a hair of your head shall perish? I mean, isn't that a contradiction? Well, no, it's not. Jesus is saying, not a hair of your head shall perish in the sense that we say, well, it's no skin off my back. You see, in other words, they might kill your body, but you will be escorted into eternity. And I guaranteed that the moment you are there, you won't care one jot about what you lost on earth concerning anything you give up for the Lord. Be it a boyfriend you let go because he doesn't want to walk with God, or a job you've been fired from because you're not willing to compromise in the area of integrity, or even your life itself. I promise you that when you get to heaven, you're not going to say, oh, I wish I would have kept that. And I'll tell you something else too. He says not a hair of your head's going to perish. When we get to heaven in our resurrection bodies, I reckon most of us are going to have more hair than we do now, which is the theory I'm working on anyway. So there's a kind of reclamation project that's going on. And now he begins in verse 20, as we get there, to answer their question earlier about the temple being torn down and when shall these things be? Because they think he's talking about the end of the world. They can't imagine any situation where the temple, as glorious as it was, and as long as it took to build, would be taken down or come down in any shape or form. And I believe that Jesus answers their question about that in Matthew and Mark. But here in Luke, he says, no, look, all of these other things are going to happen before the temple's torn down. They're going to persecute you and you're going to see some very difficult things. But don't be shocked when they happen. Because this is the world you're headed into. But the temple is going to be torn down. And he says in verse 20, And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. So he's specifically speaking here in Luke about the siege of Jerusalem leading up to the temple being torn down, and also about Judea. He says so. He said, let those that are in Judea at that time flee to the mountains. He says, let not those that are in the countryside around enter into Jerusalem. For these be the days of vengeance, he says, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. So look, and this is really important. Matthew and Mark speak of some of the same things, fleeing to the mountains and so forth and not going back. But when they say it, it's in the context of something different, because they're talking about things that happen in the last days. And it's very important that we understand that only Luke picks up on a different part of Jesus' teaching. Matthew 24 verse 15 says, when you see the desolation of abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet, let him who reads understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and those that are in the field not go back. Those that are on the housetop, don't go down in the house to get your clothes. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. And Mark says similar. But that's nothing to do with us, is it? Because we don't observe the Sabbath. That's in a Jewish context of the Antichrist in the last days. There are some things in Matthew and Mark that are the same, but here in Luke, it's a precursor to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. He says, when you shall see Jerusalem surrounded with armies. He doesn't say when you shall see the desolation of abomination. Luke is giving us a different picture. He says, then know the desolation of Jerusalem is nigh. And on Palm Sunday, if you remember, Luke recorded that when Jesus rode into the city, he beheld it, he looked at it, and he wept. He was convulsing and he was crying, and he said, if you had known at least in this your day the things that belong to your peace, but now that are hid from your eyes, for the days shall come upon you that your enemies shall cast a trench about you and compass you round about and keep you in on every side and shall lay you even with the ground. He says there they're going to level the cities and your children within you, and they shall not leave you one stone upon another, because you knew not the time of your visitation. And it says that he's weeping as he says that. Now he's telling them, look, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then, and he gives three directives in verse 21. Number one, he says, if you're living in the area of Judea, flee to the mountains. Number two, he says, let those who are in the midst of it, in other words, if you're in Jerusalem, get out. And number three, if you're living in the outlying districts, don't run to the city for refuge. Because in that culture, when invading armies came, you usually ran into the city to take refuge behind the city walls. So this is a completely different picture that Luke has given us here, because he says, these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written be fulfilled. But woe to them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land of Israel, and wrath upon this people, the Jews. So he's looking here at the horrendous things that will happen there in AD 70. Look at verse 24. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. That doesn't happen at the desolation of abomination in the last days, does it? And you'll only find this in one place, in this verse in Luke. The times of the Gentiles. So take note of that. And take note of the context it's written in as well, because so many people like to take this and run with it. Josephus tells us that because the siege of Jerusalem began in April, all of the Passover crowds were trapped inside the city walls when the siege began. And at the end of it, 97,000 people are led away prisoners, and many of them end up in arenas being fed to lions. And the rest of them end up as slaves. And they're taken to all parts of the world, into all nations, as the Romans conquered them, just as Jesus says here. But there are 1.1 million people who die in Jerusalem itself. And the Romans then changed the name of Israel to Palestina, Palestine. And they called the land Palestine because in their tongue it means Philistine. And as we know, the Philistines were perennial enemies of Israel. So they wanted it to be an insult to the Jews. And today, all of the Jews that were born in Israel before 1948, their birth certificate says they're Palestinian. That was just what the land was called. There was no group of people called the Palestinians. It was just the name Philistine that the Romans gave to the land. But here, in this verse in Luke that we're looking at, it says they're going to be carried into all nations of the world. And that's just what happened under Roman rule. And then Jerusalem is going to be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And we want to understand what the times of the Gentiles means. Because that began in 606 BC when Nebuchadnezzar came into the city for the third time and burnt the temple and the city. And that's when the times of the Gentiles begin. And for your information, the temple in AD 70 is burnt down on exactly the same day in the Jewish calendar as Nebuchadnezzar burnt down the earlier temple hundreds of years before that. And you can find the whole outline of it in Daniel chapter 2. And the Gentile nations have ruled over Israel ever since. First there were the Persians, then there were the Babylonians, then the Greeks, then the Romans, and then after the Romans the Arabs, then the Crusaders, then the Mamelukes, the Muslims were there, and Great Britain ends up there, and finally it goes to the UN. Even in Israel today, the Jews are back in control of Jerusalem, but the Temple Mount is still in the hands of the great Mufti and the Muslims. They built a bus garage there. They still don't possess the heart of their own city. And you look at all the nations in the world today, and they're still telling Israel what to do. So where do we stand now? That's the question. We have this diaspora described here in these verses, and the times of the Gentiles going from Nebuchadnezzar all the way through to the days of the Antichrist until the return of Jesus Christ. And we know that because Revelation chapter 11, verses 1 and 2 says, "And there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple," which obviously is rebuilt by then, "and the altar and them that worship therein. But the cord which is without the temple, leave out, measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles." Listen, "and the holy city they shall tread underfoot 42 months. So it tells us there that Jerusalem is trodden underfoot until Jesus Christ returns at the end of the great tribulation. 42 months is 3.5 years. And that whole period is the times of the Gentiles. When you read Romans chapter 11 verse 25, it speaks to the fact that God has not forsaken his ancient people. God forbid, it says. And it takes you in great depth throughout that chapter. And it says that you and I, as Gentiles, should not be haughty, because you and I, as Gentiles, have been grafted into Israel, into the natural olive tree, and we've been benefited by their nation's Messiah. And it says, but the blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles is gathered in. Now, it doesn't say times of the Gentiles there. Those are two very distinct things. The gathering in of the Gentiles, or the fullness of the Gentiles, speaks of the church and about the Gentiles being saved. So the fullness of the Gentiles goes from Pentecost to the rapture. The times of the Gentiles speaks of the repression of Jerusalem from Nebuchadnezzar to the return of Jesus Christ, and it's about the treading down of Jerusalem. And it says, when the last Gentile is saved and the church is caught away, then Israel begins to see again. She has her eyes opened. Blindness in part has happened until the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. That's why, as a church, we're looking to see people get saved through you guys. Because we're hoping that when the last one gets in, we're out of here. It's why we want you all to be a lean, mean preaching machine. We want you to be out there sharing your faith with everyone. But we see the Jews scattered throughout the world, as it says in this verse. Exactly as it says in this verse. Persecuted throughout the history, but still as a people, maintaining their identity. And throughout Europe, the Jews were scattered and forbidden to be landowners. Did you know that? The people hated them. They couldn't buy farms. They weren't allowed to own land. So they became professionals. They became bankers. They became jewelers. They became lawyers. So then the world starts to hate them because they control all the money. But when the land of Israel was repatriated after 1948, doctors and lawyers had to come back to Israel to learn how to drive a plough so that they could plant out the ground. They've been persecuted throughout history, and yet somehow they've remained a nation. And around 140 years ago, in the 1880s, there began to be a trickle back to the land of Israel. And that's important because it's happened in comparatively modern times, in the days we're living in. And we live every day in the light of it. Mark Twain said this in 1889. He said, "The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose and filled the planet with sound and splendour, and then faded to the stuff of dreams and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed, made vast noise and are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but are burnt out and sit in the twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and are now what they have always been, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmity of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?" That's Mark Twain over 100 years ago. Bishop J.C. Ryle, a particular favourite of mine, wrote this in 1867. He said, he wrote this long before Israel became a nation. He said, "Now, how shall we account for this extraordinary state of things? How shall we explain the unique and particular position that the Jewish people occupy in the world? Why is it that unlike the Saxons and the Danes and the Normans and the Flemings, this singular race of over 1.5 billion inhabitants still floats alone, though broken in pieces like a wreck on the waters of the globe. In 1800 years they are neither destroyed nor are they crushed. They haven't evaporated nor are they amalgamated, nor are they lost sight of. But they live to this day as a separate and distinct, as separate and distinct as it was when the Arch of Titus was built in Rome. God has many witnesses as to the truth of the Bible, if men would only examine them and listen to their evidence. But you may depend on it, there is no witness so unanswerable as the one who always keeps standing up and living and moving before the eyes of mankind. That witness, he said, is the Jew. And, you know, listen, we talk about these things today, but please understand, I'm not a political guy. This isn't political stuff. This is biblical stuff. This is spiritual stuff. And it's important for us to understand that. And I could go on because there are many other things that I could cover this morning about the nation of Israel. And any one of these facts would be remarkable. But taken together, they are miraculous. You know, David Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel after 1948, when they proclaimed their independence, said this: "If you know the story of Israel and what happened here, and you do not believe in miracles, you are not realistic. Something is wrong with you." The whole of biblical prophecy is fulfilled with Israel becoming a nation again and Jerusalem. In fact, the prophecies about the Antichrist signing a 7-year peace treaty can't be fulfilled unless that happens. There can't be an abomination of desolation and the temple desecrated unless these Jewish people are brought together again from all over the world. And when they came back in 1948, none of them spoke the Jewish language. They spoke the languages of the countries they'd been scattered to and had returned from. One man, Eliezer ben Yudah, decided that the proper tongue for the Jewish people, who were now back in the land of the prophets, was the language of the prophets. So he began teaching children. And today, Hebrew is spoken daily by every man, woman and child in Israel. By contrast, what country or people do you know today that is speaking Egyptian or Syrian or Latin? Only the Jewish people have successfully regained the use of their original language in everyday life. And here we read in Luke this morning that they are to be scattered throughout the world, but they're to be regathered again and have their identity again. They have to be, or what we read in the Bible is untrue. So these are very important verses, and I make no apologies for spending time on them today. In the Valley of the Dry Bones, God says to Ezekiel, "I will take the children of Israel from among the nations, whether they be gone. And I will scatter them, I will gather them on every side, and I will bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel." God says three things there. First of all, he says, "I'm going to gather them together again one day from every side, from every direction." Secondly, "I'm going to gather them together in their own land." And thirdly, "And when I gather them, I'm going to make them a nation again." You and I have seen and live in the days where those things have taken place. And it is a miracle that is all around us today. So again, listen. You know, we sit here this morning and we may worry about, well, you know, what about the economy? Where's that going? And what about what's going to happen if the virus continues? And we think about all of this stuff. And every day in front of our very eyes in the news, there is a miracle that 2,000 years has never seen. And that is Israel in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem rather, becoming the stumbling blocks of the nations. And just like Zechariah said they would. And we can prove that the Bible is true, so don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Because we are sitting, you and I are sitting in the front row. And in 2,000 years, no generation of the church has sat where you're sitting this morning. So don't belittle what God has done and is doing now, right before our very eyes in our lifetime. You know, people say, don't they, oh, if only I'd been there when God was performing miracles, then I would believe. Well, he is, and you should, because it's true. And it should be marvellous in our eyes. Let's bow our hearts to pray.